This is Audible.
Dove Audio presents Gideon's Spies by Gordon Thomas, read by Theodore Bickel.
When the red light blinked on the bedside telephone, a sophisticated recording device was automatically activated in the Paris apartment near the Pompidou Center in the lively 4th arrondissement. The light had been wired in by an Israeli communications technician who had flown from Tel Aviv to install the recorder, intended to allay any suspicions neighbors would have about the phone ringing at ungodly hours. The technician was one of the Yahalomim, a member of a Mossad unit that dealt with secure communications in the safe houses of Israel's secret intelligence agency. The one in Paris was like all the others. It had a bomb-proof front door and window glass, which, like the panes in the White House, could deflect scanners. There were scores of such apartments in all the major cities in the world, either purchased outright or rented on long leases. Many were left unoccupied for lengthy periods, ready for the time they would be needed for an operation. One had been conducted from the Paris apartment since June 1997, when Monsieur Maurice had arrived. He spoke fluent French with a slight Central European accent. Over the years, his neighbors had encountered others like him, men, and occasionally women, who arrived without warning, spent weeks or months among them, then one day were gone. Like his predecessors, Maurice had politely discouraged interest in himself or his work. Maurice was a Katza, a Mossad field agent. Physically, he was nondescript. It had been said that even on an empty street he would pass virtually unnoticed. He had been recruited in what was still a halcyon time for Mossad, when its legend remained largely intact. His potential was spotted during Israel's compulsory military service, when after boot camp he had been drafted into Air Force intelligence. An aptitude for languages, he knew French, English, and German, had been noted, along with other qualities. He was good at filling gaps in a case study and drawing fact out of speculation, and he knew the limits of informed conjecture. Above all, he was a natural manipulator of people. He could persuade, cajole, and if all else failed, threaten. Since graduating from the Mossad training school in 1982, he had worked in Europe, South Africa, and the Far East. At various times, he had done so under the guise of a businessman, a travel writer, and a salesman. He had used a number of names and biographies drawn from the library of aliases maintained by Mossad. Now he was Maurice, once more a businessman. Maurice was glad to be out of Tel Aviv and back in the field. The operation which had brought him to Paris had provided another chance to show he was a methodical and careful agent, one able to deliver what was expected. In this case, the task was relatively simple. There was no real physical danger, only the risk of embarrassment should the French authorities discover what he was doing and quietly deport him. The Israeli ambassador knew Maurice was in Paris, but had not been told why. That was standard operational procedure. If things went wrong, the envoy could plead ignorance. Maurice's task was to recruit an informer. His target was Henri Paul, assistant chief of security of the city's Ritz Hotel, who also acted as chauffeur to its celebrity guests. The hotel was a meeting place for Middle Eastern arms brokers and their European contacts. Mossad had decided to have an informer in the Ritz who would be able to report on their activities. It had set about the task by first obtaining the hotel's staff list. This had been done by hacking into the Ritz computer system. No one at the hotel's senior management level appeared to be a likely prospect. Junior staff did not have the overall accessibility to guests for the task required. But Henri Paul's responsibility for security meant every area of the Ritz was open to him. His passkey could access a guest's safe deposit box. There would be no questions asked if he wanted a copy of a person's hotel bill, no raised eyebrows if he asked to see the hotel's telephone log to obtain details of calls made by arms dealers and their contacts. He could know which woman a dealer had discreetly hired for a contact. As chauffeur to VIPs, Paul would be in a good position to overhear their conversations, witness their behavior, see where they went, whom they met. The next stage had been to create a psychological profile of Paul. Over several weeks, information on his background had been unearthed by one of the resident Katzas in Paris. Using a number of covers, including an insurance company employee and a telephone salesman, the Katza had learned that Paul was a bachelor in no permanent relationship, lived in a low-rent apartment, and drove a black Mini but liked fast cars and racing the motorcycle of which he was part owner. Hotel staff had spoken of his liking a drink. There had been hints that from time to time he had used the services of an expensive hooker who also serviced some of the hotel's guests. The information had been evaluated by a Mossad psychologist. He had concluded that there was an inherent vulnerability about Henri Paul. The psychologist had recommended that steadily increasing pressure, linked with the promise of substantial monetary reward to finance Paul's social life, could be the best way to recruit him. The operation could be a lengthy one, requiring considerable patience and skill. Rather than make further use of the resident Katza, Maurice would be sent to Paris. As in any such Mossad operation, Maurice had followed weltered guidelines. First, over several visits, he had familiarized himself with the Ritz and its environs. He had quickly identified Henri Paul, a muscular man with a certain swagger in his walk, who had made it apparent that he sought approval from no one. Maurice had observed the curious relationship Paul had with the paparazzi, who staked out the front of the Ritz, ready to snatch photographs of the more newsworthy rich and famous guests. From time to time, Paul would order the photographers to leave, and usually they would do so, circling the block on their motorcycles before returning. During those short trips, Paul would sometimes emerge from the hotel staff entrance and engage the paparazzi in friendly banter as they passed. At nights, Maurice had observed Paul drinking with several of the paparazzi in one of the bars around the Ritz he patronized with other staff after work. In progress reports to Tel Aviv, Maurice had described Paul's ability to drink considerable amounts of alcohol, yet appear stone-cold sober. Maurice also confirmed that Paul's suitability for the role of informer overrode his personal habits. He appeared to have the essential access and a position of high trust. At some point in his discreet surveillance, Maurice discovered how Paul was betraying that trust. He was receiving money from the paparazzi for providing details of guest movements, enabling the photographers to be in a position to snatch pictures of the celebrities. The exchange of information for cash took place either in one of the bars or in the narrow Rue Cambon, where the Ritz staff entrance was situated. By mid-August, that exchange had focused on the expected arrival at the Ritz of Diana, Princess of Wales, and her new lover, Dodi El Fayed, the son of the hotel's owner. They would stay in the fabled imperial suite. All the Ritz staff were under strict instructions to keep details about Diana's arrival secret under penalty of instant dismissal. Despite this, Paul had continued to risk his career by providing details of the forthcoming visit to several paparazzi. From each, he had received further sums of money. Maurice saw that Paul had also begun to drink more heavily and had overheard Ritz staff complain that the assistant security chief had become even more of a martinet. He had recently fired a floor maid he had caught stealing a bar of soap from a guest bedroom. Several of the hotel's employees said that Paul was also taking pills and wondered if they were to help control his mood swings. Everyone agreed Paul had become more unpredictable. One moment he would be good-humored, the next he would display barely controlled anger over some imagined slight. Maurice decided the time had come to make his move. The first contact was in Harry's bar in the Rue Daunou. When Paul came in, Maurice was already sipping a cocktail. The Mossad Katza smoothly struck up a conversation, and the security man accepted a drink after Maurice mentioned that friends of his had stayed at the Ritz. Maurice added that they had been surprised how many other guests had been wealthy Arabs. If it had been a shot in the dark, it produced a staggering result. Paul replied that many of the Arabs were rude and arrogant and expected him to jump when they raised a finger. Worst were the Saudis. Maurice mentioned he had heard that Jewish guests were just as difficult. Paul would have none of it. He insisted that Jews were excellent guests. On that promising note, the evening ended with an arrangement to meet again in a few days over dinner at a restaurant near the Ritz. During the meal, Paul confirmed, under Maurice's well-timed questions, much of what the Katzan knew. The hotel security chief spoke of his passion for fast cars and his liking for piloting a small aircraft, but it was difficult to enjoy those habits on his salary. That may well have been the moment Maurice began to exert pressure. Finding money was always a problem for such hobbies, but not an insoluble one. Almost certainly, that perked Paul's interest. What followed then developed a rhythm of its own. Maurice laying down the bait and Paul all too eager to take it. The hook in place, Maurice would then have begun to reel in the line with the skills he had acquired at the Mossad training school. At some point, Maurice would have planted the idea he might be able to help, perhaps mentioning he worked for a company that was forever looking for ways to update its database and would pay good money to those who could help do so. This was a favorite opening gambit for Mossad recruiters on a cold approach operation. From there, it would be a small step to tell Paul that many of the Ritz guests no doubt possessed the kind of information that would interest the company. Paul, perhaps uneasy at the turn of the conversation, may have balked. Maurice would have then moved to the next stage, saying that, of course, while he understood Paul's reservations, they did come as a surprise to him. After all, it was common knowledge that Paul already took payment for information from the paparazzi. So why turn away the chance to make some real money? Maurice's undoubted skill at delivering his proposition and accompanying revelations of how much he knew of Paul's background would have been delivered with a combination of worldliness and persuasion, with the essential undertow of pressure. It would also have had an effect on Paul. Even if he had not asked, he may well have realized that the man seated across from him at the dinner table was an intelligence officer, or at least a recruiter for a service. That may well be the reason for his response. According to an Israeli intelligence source who has a certain knowledge of the matter, Henri Paul came straight out with it. Was he being asked to spy? If so, what was the deal? Just like that. No hedging, no bullshit. Just what was the deal, and whom would he really be working for? That would have been the point when Maurice would have had to decide. Did he tell Paul he would be working for the Mossad? There's no standard operational procedure for something like this. Every target is different. But Henri Paul was on the hook. If so, Maurice may well have told Paul what would be required of him, obtaining information on guests, perhaps even bugging their suites, and noting whom they entertained. There would have been discussions about payment, accompanied by an offer to open an account in a Swiss bank, or if need be, to pay Paul in cash. Maurice would have given the impression that such matters were not a problem. At that point, he may even have revealed that Paul would be working for the Mossad. All this would be standard for the successful conclusion of a cold approach operation. Paul was very probably scared at what he was asked to do. It was not a question of his loyalty to the Ritz. Like other members of the staff, he worked for the hotel because of the relatively high salary and the perks. Paul was understandably frightened. He was getting in over his head and could well end up in prison if he was found spying on the hotel's guests. Yet if he went to the police, what would they do? Maybe they already knew that he was going to be propositioned. If he turned down the proposition, what then? If the hotel management learned he had already betrayed that most precious of all assets the Ritz offered, confidentiality, by informing the paparazzi, he could be fired, even prosecuted. For Henri Paul, in those last days of August 1997, there seemed no way out. He continued to drink, to take pills, to sleep restlessly, to bully junior staff. He was a man teetering close to the edge. Maurice maintained the pressure. He often managed to be in a bar where Paul was drinking off duty. The Katzer's very presence could only have been a further reminder to the security chief of what he was being pressured to do. Maurice continued to visit the Ritz, sipping an aperitif in one of the hotel bars, lunching in its restaurant, taking afternoon coffee in a lounge. To Henri Paul, it would have seemed as if Maurice had become a personal shadow. That would have only further increased the pressure on him, reminding him that there was no way out. Compounding the pressure was the forthcoming visit of Princess Diana and Dodi Al-Fayed. Paul had been put in charge of their security while they were in the hotel, with particular responsibility for keeping away the paparazzi. At the same time, the photographers were calling him on his cell phone, seeking information about the visit. He was being offered large sums of money to provide details. The temptation to accept was another pressure. Everywhere he turned, there seemed to be pressure. Though he managed to conceal it, Henri Paul was unraveling mentally. He was taking antidepressants, sleeping pills, and pep pills to get him through the day. This combination of drugs could only have furthered the strain on his ability to make reasoned judgments. The blinking light signaling an incoming telephone call, which awoke Maurice, was timed by the recorder at 1:58 a.m. on Sunday, August 31st, 1997. The caller worked in the Paris Gendarmerie Accident Unit and had been recruited by Mossad some years before. Its computers classified him as a Mabua, a non-Jewish informer. On the totem pole of Maurice's Parisian contacts, his caller was somewhere near the bottom. Nevertheless, the man's news about a traffic accident stunned Maurice. It had occurred less than an hour before, when a Mercedes sedan had struck a reinforced concrete pillar on the westbound roadway of the underpass beneath the Place de l'Alma, a notorious accident spot in the city. The dead were Diana, Princess of Wales, mother of the future King of England, Dodi Al-Fayed, son of Mohammed, the Egyptian-born owner of Harrods of Knightsbridge, the Royal Store, and Henri Paul. The couple's bodyguard had been critically injured. Hours after the accident, Maurice flew back to Tel Aviv, leaving in his wake questions that would remain unanswered. What part had his pressure played in the accident? Had Henri Paul lost control of the Mercedes, causing it to smash into the 13th concrete pillar of the underpass beneath the Place de l'Alma, because he could see no way of extricating himself from the clutches of the Mossad? Was that pressure linked to the high level of prescribed drugs found in his bloodstream? When he had left the Ritz with his three passengers, had his mind continued to vacillate over what he should do about the pressure? Was he not only responsible for a terrible road accident, but also the victim of a ruthless intelligence agency? Questions would continue to fester in the mind of Mohammed Al-Fayed. In February 1998, he publicly announced, "It was no accident. I am convinced of that in my heart of hearts. The truth cannot remain hidden forever." 5 months later, the British network TV screened a documentary that claimed Henri Paul had close links to French intelligence. He had none. The program also hinted that an unnamed intelligence agency had been involved in the deaths. There were dark hints that the agency had acted because the British establishment feared Diana's love for Dodi could have political repercussions because he was an Egyptian. To this day, Mossad's involvement with Henri Paul has remained a well-kept secret, the way the service had always intended it should remain. Mossad acted at the behest of no one outside Israel. Indeed, few outside the service still have any idea of Mossad's part in the deaths of then the most famous woman in the world. Mohammed Al-Fayed, prompted by what he saw as a campaign of vilification in the English media, has continued to claim that unnamed security services had been ranged against his son and Diana. In July 1998, two Time magazine journalists published a book which included the suggestion that Henri Paul could have had some connection with French intelligence. Neither Al-Fayed or the journalists offered any conclusive proof that Henri Paul was an intelligence agent or even an informer, and none of them came near to identifying Mossad's involvement with him. In July 1998, Mohammed Al-Fayed asked a number of questions in a letter he sent to every one of Britain's members of Parliament. he wrote of a plot to get rid of Diana and his son, and attempted to link all kinds of disparate events with his questions. Why did it take 1 hour and 40 minutes to get the princess to hospital? Why have some of the photographers failed to give up some of the pictures they shot? Why was there a break-in that night at the London home of a photographer who handles paparazzi pictures? Why have all the closed-circuit television cameras in that part of Paris produced not one frame of videotape? Why were the speed cameras on the route out of film and the traffic cameras not switched on? Why was the scene of the crash not preserved but reopened to traffic after a few hours? Who was the person in the press group outside the Ritz who was equipped like a news photographer? Who were the two unidentified men mingling in the crowd who later sat at the Ritz bar? They ordered in English, watching and listening in a marked way. Mossad had no interest in the relationship between Diana and Dodi. Their sole concern was to recruit Henri Paul as their informer in the Ritz. Regarding the mysterious news photographer, in the past Mossad have allowed its agents to pose as journalists. It may well have been Maurice keeping watch outside the hotel. The two unidentified men in the hotel bar may have had some connection to Mossad. It would no doubt comfort Mohammed El Fayed if that were true. Some of Maurice's colleagues have increasingly felt that the attempt to entrap Henri Paul was additional proof that Mossad has lurched a little further out of control, carrying out reckless international operations without taking into account the potential long-term consequences for itself, for Israel, for peace in the Middle East, and ultimately for the relationship with the Jewish state's oldest and closest ally, the United States of America. Several officers claimed that since Benjamin Netanyahu became prime minister in 1996, matters have worsened. Another experienced Israeli intelligence officer was equally blunt. Netanyahu behaves as if Mossad is part of his own version of the court of King Arthur. Something new every day, or the knights of his own round table get bored. The first lesson I learned during a quarter of a century of writing about secret intelligence is that deception and disinformation are its stock in trade, along with subversion, corruption, blackmail, and sometimes assassination. Agents are trained to lie and to use and abuse friendships. They are the very opposite of the dictum that gentlemen do not read each other's mail. I first encountered their behavior while investigating many of the great spy scandals of the Cold War, the betrayal of America's atomic bomb secrets by Klaus Fuchs, and the compromising of Britain's MI5 and MI6 by Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, and Kim Philby. Each made treachery and duplicity his byword. I also was one of the first writers to gain access to the CIA's obsession with mind control, a preoccupation the agency was forced to confirm 10 years after my book on the subject, Journey into Madness, appeared. Denial is the black art all intelligence services long ago perfected. Nevertheless, in getting to the truth, I was greatly helped by two professional intelligence officers. Joachim Kraner, my late father-in-law, who ran an MI6 network in Dresden in the post-World War II years, and Bill Buckley, who was station chief of the CIA in Beirut. Physically, they were similar, tall, lean, and trim, with chins ready to confront trouble halfway. Their eyes revealed little, except to say, if you weren't part of the answer, you had to be part of the problem. Intellectually formidable, their criticism of the agencies they served at times was astringent. Both constantly reminded me that a great deal can be heard from what Bill called murmurs in the mush, a deadly skirmish fought in an alley with no name, the collective hold your breath when an agent or network is blown, a covert operation which could have undone years of overt political bridge building, a snippet of mundane information that completed a particular intelligence jigsaw. Joachim added that sometimes a few words, casually offered, could often throw a new light on something. Proud of being members of what he called the second oldest profession, both not only were my friends, but convinced me that secret intelligence is the key to fully understanding international relations, global politics, and diplomacy, and of course, terrorism. Through them, I made contacts in a number of military and civilian intelligence agencies. Germany's BND and France's DGSE, the CIA, Canadian and British services. Joachim died in retirement. Bill was murdered by Islamic fundamentalists who kidnapped him in Beirut and triggered the Western hostage crisis in that city. I also met members of Israel's intelligence community who first helped me by filling in the background of Mehmet Ali Aksa, the Turkish fanatic who attempted to assassinate Pope John Paul in St. Peter's Square, Rome, in May 1981. Those contacts were arranged by Simon Wiesenthal, the renowned Nazi hunter and an invaluable Mossad source for over 40 years. Because of his fame and reputation, Wiesenthal still finds doors readily open, especially in Washington. It was in that city, in March 1986, that I learned a little more of the tangled relationship between the intelligence communities of the United States and Israel. I was there to interview William Casey, then the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, as ongoing research for my book, Journey into Madness, which deals in part with the death of Bill Buckley. Despite his customized suit, Casey was a shambling figure. His jowled face was pale, and the rims of his eyes were red as we sat in a Washington club. He looked like someone whose ectoplasm was running out after 5 years of directing the CIA. Over a Perrier, he confirmed the conditions for our meeting. No notes, no tape recordings. He sat, watchful and waiting for my first question. What could he tell me about Bill Buckley? "You speak to Admoni, or any of his people?" Casey interrupted. In 1982, Nahum Admoni had become head of Mossad. On Tel Aviv's embassy cocktail circuit, he had a hard-nosed reputation. Casey characterized Admoni as a Jew who'd want to win a pissing contest on a rainy night in Gdansk. "He can listen in half a dozen languages," was Casey's judgment. Admoni was a soft-spoken intelligence bureaucrat who, when he became Mossad's chief, in Casey's words, ran a tight ship. "Socially gregarious, he has as keen an eye for women as for what's best for Israel." By the time we realized Admoni was going to do nothing, Bill Buckley was dead. Casey sipped more water, locked in his own time capsule. His next words came out flat, like a jury foreman handing down a verdict. Next thing Admoni was selling us a bill of goods that the PLO were behind the kidnapping. We knew the Israelis were always ready to blame Yasser Arafat for anything, and our people did not buy at first. But Admoni was very plausible. He made a good case. By the time we figured it wasn't Arafat, it was long over for Buckley. What we didn't know was that Mossad had also been playing real dirty pool, supplying the Hezbollah with arms to kill the Christians, while at the same time giving the Christians more guns to kill the Palestinians. Casey's less than full glimpse of what the CIA now believed had happened to Bill Buckley, that Mossad had deliberately done nothing to save him in the hope the PLO could be blamed, so frustrating Arafat's hopes of gaining sympathy in Washington, provided a chilling insight into the relationship between two intelligence services supposedly friendly with each other. Before we parted, Casey had a final thought. "A nation creates the intelligence community it needs. America relies on technical expertise because we are concerned to discover rather than secretly rule. The Israelis operate differently. Mossad, in particular, equates its actions with a country's survival. This attitude has long made Mossad immune to close scrutiny. But in 2 years of research for this book, a series of mistakes, scandals in some cases, has forced the service into Israel's public consciousness. Questions have been asked, and if the answers are rarely volunteered, gaps have begun to appear in the protective body armor Mossad has worn against that outside world. I spoke to more than 100 persons, either directly employed by or working indirectly for Israeli and other intelligence services. Several urged I should focus on recent events. The past should only be used to illustrate events which are relevant to Mossad's role at the cutting edge of the current frontiers of espionage and intelligence gathering. Many interviews were with participants who had not been questioned before. Often no amount of probing could produce a comfortingly simple explanation for the way they or others behaved. Many were surprisingly frank, though not all agreed to be fully identified. In the case of serving Mossad personnel, they are prevented by Israeli law from voluntarily allowing their names to be published. Some of the non-Israeli sources asked and received a guarantee of anonymity. On the organization charts newspapers try to piece together and publish, many sources remain among the empty spaces. They still take their anonymity seriously, and some wish to be known in these pages by an alias or only a first name. It does not make their testimony less valid. Their personal motives for breaking silence may be many: a need to secure their own place in history, a desire to justify their actions, the anecdotage of old men, even perhaps expiation. The same can be said for those who agreed to be identified. Perhaps the best motive of all, which drove them to break silence, was a real and genuine fear that an organization they had served with pride was increasingly endangered from within, and that the only way to save it was to reveal what it had achieved in the past and what it is doing today. To understand both requires knowing how and why it was created. Since dawn, the faithful had come to the most sacred wall in the world, the only remaining relic of Herod the Great's second temple in Jerusalem, the Wailing Wall. The young and the old, the lean and the fat, the bearded and the balding, all had made their way through the narrow streets or from outside the city walls. Office clerks walked alongside shepherds from the hills beyond Jerusalem. Newly bar mitzvahed youths proudly marched with men in the winter of their years. Uniformly dressed in black, each carried a prayer book and stood before the towering wall to recite portions of scripture. Down the centuries, Jews had done that. But this Sabbath Eve, in September 1929, was different. Rabbis had urged as many men as possible to be united in public prayer and to show their determination to their right to do so. It was intended not only as an expression of their faith, but also as a reminder to the Arab population, who vastly outnumbered them, that they would not be cowed. For months, there had been persistent rumors that the Muslim population were once more becoming increasingly angry over what they saw as Zionist expansion. These fears had started with the 1917 Balfour Declaration and its commitment to a formal Jewish homeland in Palestine. To Arabs who lived there and could trace their ancestry back to the Prophet, this was an outrage. Land which they had farmed for many centuries would be threatened, perhaps even taken from them, by the Zionists and their British protectors, who had arrived at the end of the Great War to place Palestine under a mandate. The British had ruled, as they did in other parts of the empire, trying to please both sides. It was a recipe for disaster. Tensions between Jews and Arabs had increased. There had been skirmishes and bloodletting, often over where the Jews wanted to build their synagogues and religious schools. But the Jews were stubbornly determined to exercise their prayer rites at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. For them, it was part of the core of their faith. By noon, the hour of the Shema prayer, there were close to 1,000 reading aloud the ancient words of Scripture before the yellow sandstone wall. The rise and fall of their voices had its own soothing cadence. Then, with stunning swiftness, missiles, stones, broken bottles, and tins filled with rubble rained down on them. The assault had been launched by Arabs from vantage points around the Wailing Wall. The first crack of gunfire rattled, a ragged volley of musket shots from Muslim marksmen. Jews fell and were dragged away by their fleeing neighbors. Miraculously, no one was killed, though the injured numbered scores. That night, the leaders of the Yishuv, the Jewish community in Palestine, met. They quickly realized that their carefully planned demonstration had lacked one essential: foreknowledge of an Arab onslaught. One of those present at the meeting spoke for them all. "We need to remember Scripture. From King David onward, our people have depended on good intelligence." over cups of Turkish coffee and sweet pastries were sown the seeds for what would one day become the most formidable intelligence service in the modern world, Mossad. But its creation was still almost a quarter of a century away. The coming to power of Hitler in 1933 marked the start of the exodus of German Jews to Palestine. By 1936, over 300,000 had made the long journey across Europe. The British continued to try and placate both sides and failed. In 1936, sporadic fighting flared into full-scale Arab revolt against both the British and the Jews. The British ruthlessly suppressed the rebellion, but the Jews realized it would only be a matter of time before the Arabs struck with renewed fury. World War II brought a renewed uneasy peace to Palestine. Jews and Arabs sensed the grim future they would both face if the Nazis won. The first detail of what was happening in the death camps of Europe had reached the Yishuv. David Ben-Gurion and Yitzhak Rabin were among those who attended a meeting in Haifa in 1942. There was consensus that the survivors of the Holocaust must be brought to their spiritual home, Eretz Israel. No one could estimate how many there would be, but everyone agreed the arrival of the refugees would rekindle confrontation with the Arabs, and this time the British would openly side against the Jews. Britain had steadfastly said it would refuse to admit the survivors into Palestine after Hitler was defeated, on the grounds it would create a population imbalance. Ben-Gurion decided that the time had come for the mandate to end. That could only be done by force. By 1946, he had united the disparate Jewish underground movements. Fired by the unquenchable spirit of those who had first settled the land, the order was given to launch a guerrilla war against both the British and the Arabs. Finally, in February 1947, Britain agreed to leave Palestine by May 1948. From then on, the United Nations would deal with the problems of what would become the State of Israel. Ben-Gurion and his commanders knew they must continue to depend on superior intelligence. Ben-Gurion, as Israel's first prime minister, set up 5 intelligence services to operate both internally and abroad. The overseas service modeled itself on Britain's and France's security services. Both those services readily agreed to work with the Israelis. Yet despite this promising start, Ben-Gurion's dream of an integrated intelligence organization working in harmony died in the birth pangs of a nation itself struggling for a cohesive identity. Finally, on March 2, 1951, Ben-Gurion summoned the heads of the 5 intelligence agencies to his office. He told them that he intended to place Israel's intelligence gathering activities abroad in a new agency called Hamossad Leteum, the Institute for Coordination. The new agency would draw its personnel from the existing intelligence agencies. In everyday usage, the new agency would be called only Mossad. Mossad, for all administrative and political purposes, would come under the jurisdiction of the Foreign Ministry. However, it would have on its staff senior officers representing the other organizations within the Israeli intelligence community: Shin Bet, Internal Security; Aman, Military Intelligence; Air Force Intelligence; and Naval Intelligence. The functions of the officers would be to keep Mossad informed of the specific requirements of their clients. In the event of disagreement over any request, the matter would be referred to the Prime Minister's office. In his usual blunt way, Ben-Gurion spelled it out. "You will give Mossad your shopping list. Mossad will then go and get the goods. It is not your business to know where they shopped or what they paid for the goods." 28 eventful years after those Jews had sat through the Jerusalem night in September 1929, discussing the vital importance of intelligence to ward off further Arab attacks, their descendants had an intelligence service which would become more formidable than any other in the world. In February 1962, the innuendos coalesced over the fate of an 8-year-old boy, Yossele Schumacher. 2 years before, the child had been kidnapped from his parents by an ultra-Orthodox sect. The boy's maternal grandfather, Nachman Starkes, was a member of the sect, Neturei Karta, the guardians of the walls of Jerusalem. He was suspected of complicity in the kidnapping. Already there had been a huge police hunt for Yosele, which had produced no clue as to his whereabouts. Nachman had been briefly imprisoned when he had refused to cooperate with the investigation. Orthodox Jews had turned the old man into a martyr. Thousands had paraded with banners, proclaiming Ben-Gurion to be no different from the Nazis, imprisoning an old man. Nachman had been released on health grounds. The protests had continued. Ben-Gurion's political advisers warned that the matter could lose him the next election. Worse, in the event of another war with the Arabs, some Orthodox groups could actually support them. The embattled prime minister had sent for Harel and ordered Mossad to find the boy. Harel argued it was not a task for the service. In his later words, "The atmosphere turned to ice. He repeated he was giving me an order. I said I needed at least to read the police file. The prime minister said I had an hour." The file was large, but as he read it, something stirred deep in Issa Harel. The right of parents to bring up their child without being pressurized by extreme religious belief. Yosele had been born in March 1953 to Arthur and Ida Schumacher. Due to family financial difficulties, Yosele had been sent to live with his grandfather in Jerusalem. The child found himself in a religious enclave, spiritually isolated from the rest of the city. Increasingly, Nachman inducted his grandson into the sect's ways. When Yosele's parents visited, Nachman angrily criticized them for what he saw as their own wayward religious attitudes. The old man belonged to a generation whose faith helped them survive the Holocaust. Nachman's daughter and son-in-law felt their prime role was to create a life for themselves in the young nation. All too often, prayer had to take second place. Tired of Nachman's constant criticism, Yosele's parents said they wanted him back. Nachman objected, arguing that to move him would disrupt Yosele's instruction into a prayer life, which would serve him as an adult. There were more angry exchanges. Then, the next time they visited Jerusalem, Yosele had disappeared. Both Orthodox and secular Jews had seized upon the incident to give full vent to an issue which continued to divide the nation and was exemplified by Ben-Gurion's Labour Party only being able to survive in office by cobbling together various religious factions in the Knesset. In turn, those groups had obtained further concessions for the strict laws of orthodoxy. But always they wanted more. Liberal Jews demanded that Yosele must be returned to his family. Having read the file, Issa Harel told Ben-Gurion he would mobilize Mossad's resources. He put together a team of agents, 40 strong, to locate Yosele. Many of them were openly opposed to what they saw as a misuse of their skills. He silenced their criticism with a short speech. "Although we will be operating outside our normal type of target, this is still a very important case. It is important because of its social and religious background. It is important because the prestige and authority of our government are at stake. It is important because of the human issues which the case involves." In the first weeks of the investigation, the team soon discovered how formidable the investigation would be. A future head of Shin Bet, then a Mossad agent, grew the curly side locks of the ultra-Orthodox and tried to penetrate their ranks. He failed. Another Mossad agent was ordered to maintain surveillance on a Jewish school. He was spotted within days. A third agent tried to infiltrate a group of Hasidic mourners traveling to Jerusalem to bury a relative within the walls of the city. He was quickly unmasked when he failed to utter the right prayers. Those failures only made Harel more determined. He told his team he was certain the child was no longer in Israel, but somewhere in Europe, or even farther afield. Harel moved his operation headquarters to a Mossad safe house in Paris. From there, he sent men into every Orthodox community in Italy, Austria, France, and Britain. When that produced nothing, he sent the agents to South America and the United States. The investigation continued to be enlivened with bizarre episodes. 10 Mossad agents joined a Saturday morning service at a synagogue in the London suburb of Hendon. The furious congregation called the police to arrest the religious impostors after their false beards came unstuck during scuffles. The agents were quietly released after the Israeli ambassador intervened with the Home Office. A venerated Orthodox rabbi was invited to Paris on the pretext that a member of a wealthy family wished him to officiate at a circumcision. He was met at the airport by two men dressed in the severe black coats and hats of Orthodox Jews. They were Mossad agents. Their report had an element of black comedy. We took him to a Pigalle brothel. Two prostitutes who had been paid by us suddenly appeared and were all over the rabbi. We took Polaroid photographs and showed them to him and said we would send them to his congregation unless he revealed where the boy was. The rabbi finally convinced us he had no idea, and we destroyed the photographs in front of him. Another rabbi, Shai Fryer, surfaced in Issa Harel's ever-expanding search through the world of Orthodox Jewry. The rabbi was picked up by Mossad agents as he traveled between Paris and Geneva. When they became convinced, after rigorous questioning, that once more this was another dead end, Harel ordered Fryer to be held a prisoner in a Mossad safe house in Switzerland until the search ended. He feared the rabbi would alert the Orthodox community. Another promising lead appeared. She was Madeleine Frey, the daughter of an aristocratic French family and a heroine of the French resistance in World War II. Madeleine had saved a large number of Jewish children from deportation to the Nazi death camps. After the war, she had converted to Judaism. Checks revealed she was a regular visitor to Israel, spending her time with members of the Neturei Karta sect, and on several occasions she had met Yossele's grandfather. Her last visit to Israel had been around the time of the boy's abduction. Madeleine had not returned to Israel since then. In August 1962, Mossad agents tracked her to the outskirts of Paris. When they introduced themselves, she physically attacked them. One of the agents summoned Issa Harel. He explained to Madeleine the great wrong done to Yossele's parents. They had the moral right to bring up their son as they wished. No parents should be denied that right. Madeleine still insisted she knew nothing about Yossele. Harel saw his own men believed her. He asked for Madeleine's passport. Beneath her photograph was one of her daughter. He asked an agent to bring him a photograph of Yossele. The facial structures of the children in both photographs were almost identical. Harel called Tel Aviv within a couple of hours. I had everything I needed to know, from details of her love life during her student days to her decision to join the Orthodox movement after renouncing her Catholic faith. I went back to Madeleine and told her, as if I knew everything, that she had dyed Yossele's hair to disguise him and smuggle the boy out of Israel. She flatly denied it. I said she must understand that the future of the country she loved was in grave danger, that in the streets of Jerusalem people she loved were throwing stones at each other. Still, she refused to admit anything. I said the boy had a mother who loved him as much as she loved all those children she had helped in World War II. The reminder worked. Suddenly, Madeleine began to explain how she had traveled by sea to Haifa, a tourist come to see Israel. On the boat, she made friends with a family of new immigrants who had a child about the age of Yossele. She had led the little girl down the gangplank at Haifa, and the immigration officer had taken the child as Madeleine's own. He made a note of this in his records. A week later, under the very noses of Israeli police, she had boarded a flight to Zurich with her daughter. Madeleine had even persuaded Yossele to dress in girl's clothing and have his hair dyed. For a while, Yossele had lived in an Orthodox school in Switzerland, where Rabbi Shai Fryer was a teacher. Following his detention, Madeleine flew with Yossele to New York, placing him with a family who were members of the Neturei Karta sect. Harel only had one more question for her. Will you give me the name and address of the family? For a long moment there was silence before Madeleine calmly said, "He is living at 126 Penn Street, Brooklyn, New York." is known as Yankele Gertner. For the first time since their encounter, Harel smiled. Thank you, Madeleine. I would like to congratulate you by offering you a job with Mossad. Your kind of talent could serve Israel well. Madeleine refused. Mossad agents flew to New York. Waiting for them was a team of FBI agents authorized to cooperate by U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy. He had received a personal request from Ben-Gurion to do so. The agents traveled to the apartment house at 126 Penn Street. Mrs. Gertner opened the door. The agents rushed past her. Inside, her husband was praying. Beside him was a pale-faced boy with a yarmulke on his head and dark side curls framing his face. Hello, Yosele. We've come to take you home, one of the Mossad men said gently. 8 months had passed since Mossad had begun its search. Close to $1 million had been spent on the operation. The safe return of Yosele did nothing to bridge the religious divide within the country. Successive governments would continue to totter and fall at the whim of small ultra-Orthodox groups elected to the Knesset. Successful though he had been in finding the boy, Issa Harel returned to Israel to face a powerful new critic, General Meir Amit, the newly appointed chief of Amman, military intelligence. Just as Harel had connived against his predecessor, he had now found himself on the receiving end of Amit's barbed criticisms over the operation to rescue Yosele. Shortly after Meir Amit took command, a man who gave his name as Salman had walked into the Israeli embassy in Paris with an astounding proposition. For $1 million in cash, he could guarantee to provide what was then the world's most secret combat aircraft, the Russian MiG-21. Salman had concluded his astounding offer to an Israeli diplomat with a bizarre request. Send someone to Baghdad, call this number and ask for Joseph, and have our $1 million ready. The diplomat sent his report to the resident Katza in the embassy. He had been one of those who had survived the purging which followed Meir Amit's appointment. The Katza sent the report to Tel Aviv, together with a phone number Salman had provided. For days, Meir Amit weighed and considered. Salman could be a confidence trickster or a fantasist, or even part of an Iraqi plot to try to entrap a Mossad agent. There was a very real risk that other Katzas working under deep cover in Iraq would be compromised. But the prospect of getting hold of a MiG-21 was irresistible. Its fuel capacity, altitude, speed, armaments, and turnaround servicing time had made it the Arab world's premier frontline fighter aircraft. Israel's Air Force chiefs would cheerfully have given many millions of dollars for just a glimpse of the MiG's blueprint, let alone for the actual plane. Meir Amit said, I went to bed thinking of it. I woke up thinking of it. I thought of it in the shower, over dinner. I thought about it every spare moment I had. Keeping up with the enemy's advanced weapon system is a priority with any intelligence service. Actually getting your hands on it almost never happens. The first step was to send an agent to Baghdad. Meir Amit created an alias for him, as English as the name in his passport, George Bacon. No one would think a Jew would have a name like that. Bacon would travel to Baghdad as the sales manager of a London-based company selling hospital X-ray equipment. He arrived in Baghdad on an Iraqi Airways flight with several sample boxes of equipment and demonstrated how well he had absorbed his brief by selling several items to hospitals. At the beginning of his second week, Bacon made the call to the number Salman had provided. I used a payphone in the hotel lobby. The risk the phone was tapped was smaller than making the call from my room. The number was answered at once. A voice asked in Farsi who was speaking. I replied in English, apologizing I must have the wrong number. The voice then asked, also in English, who was speaking. I said I was a friend of Joseph's. Was there someone there by that name? I was told to wait. I thought maybe they were tracing the call, that this was a trap after all. Then a very cultured voice was on the line, saying he was Joseph and that he was glad I had called. He then asked if I knew Paris. I thought, contact. Bacon found himself agreeing to a meeting in a Baghdad coffee house the following noon. At the appointed hour, a man smilingly introduced himself as Joseph. His face was deeply etched, his hair white. The agent's later report once more captured the surreal atmosphere of the moment. Joseph said how very pleased he was to see me, as if I was some long-awaited relative. He then started to talk about the weather and how the quality of service had dropped in cafes like this one. I thought, here I am in the middle of a hostile country whose security service would surely kill me if they had the chance, listening to an old man's ramblings. I decided, whoever he was, whatever his connection was with Salman in Paris, Joseph was certainly not an Iraqi counterintelligence officer. That calmed me. I told him my friends were very interested in the merchandise his friend had mentioned. He replied, Salman is my nephew, who lives in Paris. He's a waiter at a cafe. All the good waiters have left here. Joseph then leaned across the table and said, You have come about the MiG? I can arrange it for you, but it will cost $1 million. Just like that. Bacon sensed that perhaps after all, Joseph was more than he appeared. There was a quiet certainty about him. But as he began to question him, the old man shook his head. Not here. People could be listening. They arranged to meet again the following day on a park bench along the Euphrates River, which flowed through the city. That night, Bacon slept very little, wondering if, after all, he was being slowly hooked, if not by Iraqi intelligence, then by some clever con men who were using Joseph as a front. The next day's meeting revealed a little more of Joseph's background and motives. He came from a poor Iraqi Jewish family. As a boy, he had been employed as a servant by a rich Maronite Christian family in Baghdad. Then, after 30 years of loyal service, he had been abruptly dismissed, wrongly accused of stealing food. He found himself, on his 50th birthday, cast out into the streets. Too old to find other work, he existed on a modest pension. He had also decided to seek out his Jewish roots. He discussed his quest with his widowed sister, Manu, whose son, Munir, was a pilot in the Iraqi Air Force. Manu admitted she too had a strong desire to go to Israel, but how could they possibly do that? Even to mention the idea was to risk imprisonment in Iraq. To leave anyone behind would guarantee the authorities would punish them severely, perhaps even kill them. And where would the money come from? She had sighed and said it was all an impossible dream. But in Joseph's mind, the idea took hold. Over dinner, Munir had often told him his commander boasted that Israel would pay a fortune for one of the MiGs he flew. Perhaps even $1 million, Uncle Joseph. The sum had focused Joseph. He could bribe officials, organize an escape route. With that money, he could somehow move the entire family out of Iraq. The more he thought about it, the more feasible it became. Munir loved his mother. He would do anything for her, even stealing his plane for $1 million. And there would be no need for Joseph to have to organize the family's escape. He would let the Israelis do that. Everyone knew they were clever at such things. That was why he had sent Salman to the embassy. And now you are here, my friend. Joseph beamed at Bacon. What about Munir? Does he know any of this? Oh, yes. He has agreed to steal the MiG. But he wants half the money down now, then the balance delivered just before he does so. Bacon was astounded. Everything he had heard sounded both genuine and feasible. But first he had to report to Mayor Amit. In Tel Aviv, the Mossad chief listened for an entire afternoon while Bacon reported every detail. Where does Joseph want to be paid? Mayor Amit finally asked. Into a Swiss bank. Joseph has a cousin who needs urgent medical treatment, not available in Baghdad. The Iraqi authorities will give him permission to go to Switzerland. When he arrives, he expects to have the money already deposited by us. A resourceful man, your Joseph, Mayor Amit commented wryly. Once the money is in that account, we'll never get it back. He put one more question to Bacon. Why do you trust Joseph? I trust him because it is the only choice. Mayor Amit authorized $500,000 should be deposited in the main branch of the Credit Suisse in Geneva. He was gambling more than money. He knew he could not survive if Joseph turned out to be the brilliant fraud some Mossad officers still believed he was. The time had come to brief Prime Minister Ben-Gurion and his chief of staff, Yitzhak Rabin. Both men green-lighted the operation. Mayor Amit had not told them he had taken one more step, withdrawing the entire Mossad network from Iraq. If the mission failed, I didn't want anyone's head on the block except my own. I set up 5 teams. The first team was the communications link between Baghdad and me. They would break radio silence only if there was a crisis. Otherwise, I didn't want to hear from them. The second team was to be in Baghdad without anyone knowing. Not Bacon, not the first team, no one. They were there to get Bacon out of the country if there was trouble, and Joseph too, if possible. The third team was to keep an eye on the family. The fourth team was to liaise with the Kurds who would help in the last stages of getting the family out. Israel was supplying them with arms. The fifth team was to liaise with Washington and Turkey. For the MiG to be flown out of Iraq, it would have to fly over Turkish airspace to reach us. Washington, who had bases in northern Turkey, would have to persuade the Turks to cooperate by saying the MiG was going to end up in the United States. I now knew that the Iraqis feared the possibility of a pilot defecting to the West, so they kept fuel tanks only half full. That was something we could do nothing about. There were still other problems. Joseph had decided that not only his immediate family, but distant cousins should have the opportunity of escaping from the harsh Iraqi regime. In all, he wanted 43 persons to be airlifted to safety. Mayor Amit agreed, only to face a new worry. From Baghdad, Bacon sent a coded message that Munir was having second thoughts. The Mossad chief sensed what was happening. Munir was first and foremost an Iraqi. Iraq had been good to him. Betraying his country to Israel did not sit well. We were the enemy.